Thank you for downloading this New Zealand Sports Radio show. We have a new way that you can support us. There is a link in the notes down below where you can make a one-off donation to New Zealand Sports Radio. Thank you for support and enjoy the show.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to the Driving Mall Show. It's Paul here with you this evening. I have got Stephen joining me, but he's running a tad late, so I'll be kicking off on my own for the first quarter of an hour or so. So hopefully you can survive that and get through to when Stephen joins us here on the Driving Mall Show. What are we going to talk about? Well, we'll have a quick look at some of the news items. I also put out a call onto Twitter for some questions, and we've got a couple of questions from there talk about that I will talk about on that one. Hopefully, unfortunately, it looks like my camera is having issues. I don't know why it's thinking it's not plugged in. We'll try that again. So hopefully you've still got sound, and hopefully the camera will come back soon. I've just unplugged it and plugged it back in. We'll see what happens on that one. Otherwise, we can change which camera we're going to. So let's head over to a different camera for now. Hopefully that'll work, he says. And no, that one doesn't work either. What's going on? Oh, no. Technical issues. Sorry, folks. I just realized I got my branding wrong as well. So as you're on the podcast, won't care because, hey, who cares about what's going on with the picture when you're listening to a podcast? So I will try one more time to plug it in, and might have to go with no camera this evening if it cannot fix itself there. So sorry about the camera, folks. On that one, so it's one last try to see if we can change camera see if we get a picture, if not, we'll just get on with the show with no camera, folks. So I don't know why the camera's not working this evening, but hey, you can hear me, so hopefully that one will work. We'll have for you cope with that, and if I get some Stephen on board, then obviously we can have his lovely face on the show. Let's go off with the news then this evening, and we've had the Super Rugby fixtures have come out, with round two going to be the Super Round over in Melbourne, with all the games over there. That means that this time, though, last time it was all the New Zealand teams have taken home games over there. This time it looks like it is a bit of a mix of them, because we've got some of the games are between New Zealand teams. So Crusaders, Highlanders and Rebels, Hurricanes would be on the Friday night. Moana Pacifica and the Chiefs. Now, that's the Chiefs' home game. So I'm not quite sure which way round they are on the display I'm seeing here. And then Fiji and Drua versus Waratahs are the two games on the Saturday. And Sunday is the Blues Brumbies and the Force versus the Reds. So it looks like it's a bit of a mixture next year of different teams on that one. So we'll let's see how that pans out for that. Because, as I say, it wasn't great. There wasn't a great turnout to the show or to the Super Round last year. That was all in Melbourne. So, but there we go. It's there again for that one. Other news, the Moana Pacifica are taking one of their games over to Samoa, which is fantastic to see. Now, obviously, the travel issues have been removed. I must admit, I've not checked to see where the Fiji and Drua games are going to be, and whether all their games will be in Fiji, or if they will be hosting some of their games in Australia, like they did this year. Having a quick look on the Tribe Sports app, the best place for that. It looks like, yes, Fiji and Drua on their TBD, it says at the moment, as a venue in Fiji. So hopefully Fiji and Drua will be able to host all of their games in Fiji. Moana Pacifica, as I say, taking one game over to Samoa. All of the rest will be held or will be hosted out of Mount Smart Stadium again this round. So on that one, because of the Super Round being in Melbourne, that means that the Crusaders, Rebels, Moana, they've also got Moana to down first round. I'm pretty sure the Chiefs have had it down as one of their home games. So we'll have to see how that Super Round goes on that one. Not sure about that one as to which ones are the home teams for those games in Melbourne. The other news of that is that the Highlanders are taking a game to Invercargill, which is great to see that they are doing that. And I think I can get myself back on camera and just not on the my main camera. So there we go. You can see me here. Sometimes I'll be looking up in an odd direction, folks. Sorry, that's because my main camera has died. There we go. I don't know why it's gone and done that. So cool to see that those ones are out. Also, that the piece that came out during that was there's more positive sounding from the heads of Rugby Australia New Zealand Rugby about getting a deal done for the 2024 onwards, because the current Super Rugby deal finishes next year. It was only a 2-year deal. So we'll see what happens after that. They haven't announced the Super Rugby Aupaki bit yet. I'm not sure when that'll come out. I'd expect that to come out post the Rugby World Cup, to be honest. That would be better timing for that kind of stuff. So that's what's going on with the Super Rugby. Good to see that we've got those fixtures and there's more positive news. To be honest with you, on a launch date of fixtures for next year is not the right time to be saying, oh, we're having really tough discussions and it might not happen. So it's not surprising that they gave a positive spin to it when they announced the fixtures. I wouldn't read too much into that as to how well or how badly those discussions are going for post-2024, to be honest. The other big news to come out comes actually from the Northern Hemisphere, where their season has kicked off with URC, the Gallagher Premiership and the Top 14 all underway up there with a few rounds in already. What has been happening, though, in the UK or in England is that a couple of the teams, clubs, are in financial difficulties, namely Wasps and Worcester Warriors. Worcester Warriors in such a bad state that players, that staff weren't paid on time. I think some of them might even still have outstanding debts. Don't quote me on that one. I think still some payments might be outstanding. And they were told that they only could host their game that they had with some of the staff working for free, which shows what a mess Worcester Warriors are in. It's like a £15 million loan from the government's sports survival package. So Worcester Warriors in a right old mess. They were told by the RFU that they had to come up with a credible plan around paying their staff and being able to run their fixtures. Otherwise, they would get suspended from all competitions. And so both their men's and women's teams, the men from the Gallagher Premiership and the women from the Premier 15s, have been suspended indefinitely or awaiting what will happen from that. I believe they have gone into administration as well as the government has forced that. We'll see if that means now they can get taken over, because one group apparently was interested in taking over, but only if it went in, if the club went into administration. So we'll have to see what has happened on that one. It is a right old mess, and currently they're on track to, well, either disappearing or being relegated, which is an interesting one, as the Premiership is ring-fenced and doesn't have relegation and promotion at the moment. The other team that is in difficulty is Wasps, who moved from London up to Coventry a number of years ago, taking over the stadium in Coventry and also all of the conference facilities and hotel, which is part of the reason that that arguably some people got involved with the club, was that they actually managed to get hold of those assets around the hotel and the conference centre. Sorry, just taking a drink there. Rather than necessarily being fully interested in the rugby club, it was some of the kind of rumours and some of the talk at the time. They also are in financial difficulties and have not been able to restructure, or appear to have problems around restructuring of their loans to pay for the buying of those assets, basically, and we'll have to see what will happen with Wasps. But Wasps also precarious and could end up also in administration and potentially also relegated as well. Interestingly, off the back of all of that, there apparently have been discussions between the Premiership and the Welsh Rugby Union around Wales providing two teams to go into the Premiership. When Wales got four teams in the URC currently, how they would provide a team for the Premier, provide two teams for the Premiership is mind-boggling and a bit of a mess. Obviously, that is pure rumour, as far as I'm aware. I don't believe anyone's officially talked about that. So at the moment, club rugby in England, particularly, looks like a bit of a mess. You could suggest that perhaps this is a bit of chickens coming home to roost on this, in that only one club within the Gallagher Premiership has made a profit for a number of years, or regularly over the last years, being Exeter Chiefs, which is a members club. When you then realise that once Tony Rowe has sold off his telecoms company, the Chiefs could not find another big spending sponsor, so hence he put his new business park as a sponsor. Well, that business park is just a field at that time. So even Exeter Chiefs were, whilst they didn't have an owner, because their members club were definitely were basically being paid for or subsidised by a rich fan, effectively. And so clearly this is, when you've got all those clubs running at losses most years, most if not every year, then this, something like this was bound to happen at some stage, you might suggest. So not nice for either Wasps or Conblanc or Worcester Warriors employees and players or their fans. It's not really their fault. It's the board and the owners that are at fault for what's going on with these clubs and other innocent people getting caught basically in the outwash or the results of this. So really sad for those people, and you hope that they can get that kind of sorted. Simon in the live chat says the Irish and New Zealand central model is probably the best model that works for rugby in the professional era. The argument is yes and for and against that, because it's how well it's working in New Zealand is arguable at the moment, and there's a lot of us being pretty doom and gloom around the New Zealand Rugby's running of the sport in this country, and how player numbers have dropped, how people the number of attendees at games has dropped, consistently over the last 20 odd years. So whilst we haven't ended up in the issue that we've got now, or the issue they've got now in England, there are definitely issues. It's not to say that rugby is in a massively positive state in New Zealand currently, either with the national team or with the player numbers as well. So not all good and hunky-dory in that point of view either, to be honest. I'm hoping to talk to one or more provincial CEOs about how we're going to spend the Silver Lake money. So keep an eye out for those interviews coming up on the channel. I think it's probably going to be post-NPC, so another 3 or 4 weeks before I can get those interviews, as those people are busy at the moment with the NPC that is going on. So I think that catches us up on the key kind of bits of news so far. As I say, Stephen Harris hopefully joining us soon, and we'll go through the Rugby Championship games. But let's just catch up on some of the NPC action. Unfortunately, I didn't get to any of the games this past week, so I've not got any interviews for you. Tomorrow, myself and Stephen Harris will be at Bay of Plenty versus Northland. So don't worry, next week on the show, we will have post-match interviews from those games for you as we head into the final round of games before the finals, obviously. Last week, what do we have? Well, the midweek game was Taranaki versus Counties Manukau. Taranaki getting a good win, 25-14 there, as Counties really have collapsed over the last few rounds, losing to Taranaki, and then at the weekend also losing to Southland, 32-26. That means that Counties are currently on a, I think it was three game losing streak. After beating Manawatu, they played Canterbury at home, one you'd expect them to lose, but then to lose to both Taranaki and Count Southland, two teams who haven't been going that well this season, sees Counties Manukau slip totally out of contention for the finals. So they can't reach the finals going to this last weekend, as they're some 19.7 points behind Otago and also Hawke's Bay in that pool. So a really disappointed for Counties, who were having a positive season up until these last couple of games. Massive win for Southland, mind you, getting their first win of the season. Clearly, they're not in the contention for finals footy, but to have actually put a win together. Hopefully, you've listened to our interview with the head coach of the Southland on that one, and how they've basically been struggling because of injuries. You'll understand, it's really good to see them actually get that win on the board. Now Manawatu being the only team that hasn't had a win all season. Simon makes a good point, folks. If you are thinking about going along to the game between Bay of Plenty and Northland, it is, well, he says it's a 4:30 kickoff. I'm pretty sure it's a 4:05 kickoff, because Tauranga Domain does not have floodlights, and this is down to because that normally the evening games for Bay of Plenty are held over in Rotorua, but the international stadium over in Rotorua is having its pitch relayed, and therefore all of Bay of Plenty's games are in Tauranga, where I'll be seeing Stephen tomorrow. How are you doing, sir?
You all, good evening, Paul. Sorry, I'm a little bit late, and good evening to all your viewers on the TDM.
I mean, how slick was that bringing you in? I mean, bang, straight in there with seeing you tomorrow for the game. So, yes. So, we've lined Stephen up with a media pass as well as myself. So, we'll be all over those players and coaches like a rash, getting post-match reactions from them tomorrow down there in Tauranga, folks. Other games then from the weekend on the NPC. As I was bringing people up to speed on that one. Canterbury beat Auckland 38-20, meaning that Canterbury now have guaranteed themselves top spot in the evens pool and also the number one seeding this year. 8 wins, 1 loss in Canterbury. Stephen, looking like champions elect, someone's going to have to go through them to get the championship, aren't they?
Oh, very much so. Listen, I think they're a really, really good all-round side, as Auckland found out on the weekend. And just unfortunately, everything they did was just that little bit quicker. The speed of ball was just a little bit quicker. And Auckland started the game pretty well, but just really didn't capitalise on their opportunities. And, of course, a little bit of ill-discipline as well. But Canterbury showing they're one of those teams, once they get on a roll, they really are a hard team to beat. And listen, once again, I think, first of all, you've really got to match them in the forwards. Paul, if you don't match them in the forwards, I think it's, for any team, it's going to be a long day at the office. And quite frankly, in terms of teams to challenge them, I probably only really see maybe a full-strength Tasman team, maybe Bay of Plenty. It could be a little bit of a smoky in this NPC. And once again, Canterbury are also showing it really doesn't matter who they bring into their lineups as well. And I see they seem to have a factory of first fives at the minute. The young first five, Hartford, only playing his second or third game for Canterbury out of Christchurch Boys High. Wow, wasn't that a magnificent drop kick from the line dropout? I mean to say, fielded it just on halfway, walked it up to about the just outside the 10-metre mark, and it just did not look like missing. And, quite frankly, you know, Auckland were never in that game.
Auckland now have lost three out of the last four games and have slipped away out of, and if they're not careful, there's one game to go there in the away section of the finals below North Harbour in that pool. So, tough for now for Auckland, things not going their way. Poor run of form for them. A couple of teams are like that, to be honest. The team we're going to see tomorrow then, Bay of Plenty beat Hawke's Bay 20-14, meaning that they now are the Bay again, having won Battle of the Bays in that one. Bay of Plenty going well now, sat second behind Wellington with a game in hand. So they are, on track for finals footy and potentially even topping their pool. Hawke's Bay, mind you, leaves them in a tight battle for the playoffs with Otago. Both of them on 26 points going into this last round as they fight it out for the fourth place in that the fourth playoff place in that pool there. Tasman, Northland, your team, Stephen, had been going well this season, but 52-17, boy oh boy, Tasman did a job on Northland, who are now suddenly on a bad run of form. After beating Auckland, they've lost to Canterbury, North Harbour and Tasman. So three losses on the bounce. Really, again, another team that's earlier season good form, but struggling come the sharp end of the season.
Yeah, for sure, Paul. Three second half meltdowns, obviously, against Canterbury, North Harbour, and now against Tasman. I mean, all three games, they've started reasonably well, but I just suspect they're just taking a few knocks here and there, and they're just starting to dig a little bit into their depth. And I think that can be seen where the coaches had to roll out the same players. They've had to rest a few for tomorrow night. I know there's a change in the midfield. Kalani, excited for Kalani going, who was the standout club centre of Northern Club Rugby, coming in for his first start of the season. But I suppose the question that a lot of Taniwha supporters are asking, where is Tom Robinson? Well, Tom Robinson still suffering from concussion, shall we say, and pretty unlikely we're going to see him again this season. But that must be concerning for a man who's, been touted as an All Black, you know, or mentioned in dispatches. I personally think there's a bit of a roadblock there. But it just makes you wonder where to for his career now.
Yeah, true. That's hopefully he gets over that. It's not the first concussion for him either, and not first long-term concussion either. We have a brand new guest, so I want to bring Joey in. How are you doing, sir? Oops.
Hello, Paul.
Oh, good to have you join us. This is Joey, someone I've known from Hamilton, and also on the old Twitter. And it's his first cap on the Driving Mall Show with his. And don't believe that's his house behind him. That looks like a green screen to me. The way that it's not quite fitting around him. So technology there. It looks like he's got a grand old house, but no. In a dingy basement, I think. How are you doing, Joey?
Doing very well, thank you, here in Hamilton, City of the Future.
Oh, the Tron. Let's just wrap up the rest of the NPC games quickly, because then we want to get on to the two internationals that we've had from the weekend. Wellington saw off Waikato in that Ranfurly Shield Challenge, so defending the Shield and putting it away for the summer. Wellington, a team that I basically said had an up-and-down season, have come good now, having won their last winning six on the bounce after losing to Northland back in August. Whereas Waikato, the team that hadn't, had the longest unbeaten record, suddenly have then crashed now to both Otago and Wellington in 2 weeks on the bounce, seeing them slip out of home finals content or home finals places. So two teams heading in the different directions on that one. The next up, we had Manawatu losing to Otago 35-54. Look, Manawatu's struggling season continues, so no surprise there. Harbour saw off Taranaki 35-19. Taranaki coming to the end of their storm week. A good time for Harbour to meet them, and a good win there sees Harbour up into second place behind Canterbury in their pool. And the final game was that Southland win over Cairns Manukau 30-26, as I mentioned already. Any sort of quick thoughts from those games, boys, before I move on?
Yeah, Paul, I'll get it just before Joey, but I just want to mention that Shield Challenge. I must admit, I thought Waikato would put in probably more of a bigger challenge. I thought that was probably that was almost one of those games where they didn't really fire a shot, and unfortunately, nor did any of their big guns in this particular game. And it just seemed like score wise, it always seemed like they were in it or capable of something, but it didn't quite happen for Waikato at the end of the day. And just in terms of the rest of the results, I thought they all were pretty predictable bar that last result. Listen, really stoked for the Southland Stags. They've been close in a couple of games, especially earlier in the season, and that's a lot of credit to Dal McLeod, who's picked a lot of guys out of club rugby. So it was good to see those guys get rewarded. And they had a few injuries as well, and I know that Dal's own son, Jack McLeod, started at first five and made a pretty good fist of first five, and a pretty impressive win when you actually think that they also got a red card during the game, a 20-minute red card, came back and won that game. But, yeah, just probably the one that just disappointed me, and I know Joey might want to touch on it as well, being a man down there in the Tron. Just disappointed with that Waikato effort. I just really thought they would have thrown a little bit more at the Wellington Lions.
Yeah, it was much of the same, Stephen. You know, Waikato, I was expecting and kind of quietly hoping that they'd come away with the result and bring that Shield back up these ways. I noticed that there was a tweet there about the fake Hawks and there's only one bay. Be interesting to know what the majority of the listeners also think is the actual bay of those two. So, it's a tough one. Even like a team like Counties to go down there and play against, it was a Southland, and not come away with the result is must be disheartening for them to go all that way. And because I know what it was like when we played for Northland and went down there, it was the top of the country playing against the bottom of the country, and we know that feeling. But like you said, nice to see that. Actually, that Wellington actually put on a performance and, you know, came away with the win. And this is a bit of history in the making again for them. It's been a long time between drinks for those guys to lift the Ranfurly Shield. Don't even know when the last time was. When was it, Paul? Do you know?
Oh, well, Mr. Google will tell me in a second.
I think it was about 2000. Are we talking about Wellington? If we are, about 2007, they took it off Auckland, I think it was. If we're talking about
Wellington. It's like 15 years, isn't it? 15 years. Yeah, 15 years between drinks. So, it was nice to see a result like that for those guys, especially with Duplessis leading them. I think he, if he sticks around, he may be due some higher honours if he sorts out those parts of his game that maybe he's had a talking to from the coaching staff of the ABs.
Wellington had 11, when it had 11 times, only 40 successful defences, which is less than teams like Taranaki and Hawke's Bay. So you'd think for a big province like Wellington, they would have a stronger, that's what I'm looking for, history in the Ranfurly Shield. But it looks like they're a province that doesn't get it as often as perhaps you might think they would. And also, right, she says two disjointed efforts by Waikato in a row, running out of steam. They're a pretty chaotic style, attack style that works. When it works really, really well. When it doesn't, perhaps lacks the structure that some of the other teams have. Perhaps their all-out attack isn't, when they get shut down, they get shut down badly, unfortunately, on that one. Oh, my word. I go from having a show on my own now to being swamped with guests with John. What we'll have to do, folks, is tell John that we're not talking about South Africa for another 20 minutes. Then he'll probably disappear and come back again. So don't worry. We'll get on to it, John. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you, gentlemen. How are you all?
We're very good.
Good, thanks, John.
So that kind of wraps up our MPC side of things. I just want to go on to some questions we've had from Twitter, and then we'll get on to the internationals and rugby championship games. First up, we had one asking about my thoughts on Worcester Warriors, and I think I've already said that during the news section. So, folks, if you've joined us now, listen to the recording, wind back onto that one, and I'll talk you through those. But some questions from Twitter. Mr. Rugby says, is rugby doomed from poor officiating, or is it just as Aussies having a whinge? Would we still be whinging if we were back to number one or two in the world? The state of the game at the moment is, number one, first off, Australia's not the only ones that like to whinge, and the South Africans are very good at it too. And a few other nations as well. In fact, it seems to be every rugby fan seems to find a way about complaining, or every about the referee. The referee seems to be the majority of the conversation on Twitter during a game, which is a real sad place to be. And the fact that our game has gone into that area is a problem. Is that poor officiating? Is that poor? Is that how the players are playing, or is that the law books being set up incorrectly? I'm not sure which answer of those three it is, but it is a problem for the game, and it is causing definitely switching off a lot of people. John, as Adrian knew, I'll be the first bite of the cherry on that one.
Thank you. I think that there's a couple of things that we need to differentiate in this argument. One is, and I'm sorry to say this for all our Australian listeners and viewers, that there is a difference between a referee making a poor decision which is out of your hands and putting you and your team in a situation because you do not listen to them. And Australia, as much as they can jump up and down as a crew and as a team and as a squad and as the broadcasters and say this has never been done before, they had been warned as a team again and again and again and again to get on with it and didn't listen. So that situation could have been completely avoided if they had listened to the referee. So they put themselves in a situation where they could be affected by not following instructions. So from that perspective, you almost need to take, and it was very interesting to me to see that the referee is recently retired in the last 2 years, who refereed the last World Cup final. Everyone's favorite referee, the Welshman. What was his name? Come on, Paul, help me out here.
Nigel.
Nigel, yes. Whatever his surname is, that one. He, in his post, and I respect him a lot as a referee, he said in his opinion the decision was 100% correct. So agree with it as a precedent or not, Australia put themselves in that position. The issue that we are having that is so bad about refereeing is point number two, that although mistakes are human and referees will always make them because they cannot see everything, and I learned this recently because I've been refereeing some games and filling in as a ref, and there are times where I'm unsighted and people say, how can you not see that? There's a player standing right in front of me. I couldn't see it. The real problem that we have is on replay with time and with clear visual evidence. The video ref, the TMO, is making mistakes. And that is the part where I think we've got a major problem. Because if you can't get it right on replay and everyone can see it, then there's a serious judgment issue that's at fault here.
Yeah, absolutely. You got the TMO needs to – we need improvement TMO. When people at home can see something and TMO can't, yeah, you do wonder what's going on. Very true. Joey, thoughts on refs?
My thoughts that have always been since the beginning of, say, the third match official has been, sure, you can have a third match official to to lean on if you're not quite sure. But relying on it too much, I think, has kind of spoiled certain moments in rugby history where you expect, you know, a big finish to, you know, somebody's scored a try. It's obvious to the crowd. It's obvious to us at home watching on TV. But to the ref on the field, he may not have seen it or seen enough of it, or even his pals on the side, to give a proper call on whether or not, you know, it was legitimate. That going upstairs in those moments, yeah, maybe it's something that's needed. But I have seen moments where I really felt as a fan watching TV, I wish the ref at the time had just backed himself and made a call in the moment. Obviously, he has to see enough of it to make a call. But I feel that a lot of refs are just mitigating their risk by going upstairs every single time rather than once in a while backing themselves with a call.
To me, I think the problem there is you're asking for consistency and you're asking for a feel of the game, and somehow I don't think you can have either. You're getting it one or the other. That's the problem there. Mm. Stephen, do you want to shout on this one before I go to our next question?
Oh no, I think pretty much agree with that, John and Joey. I suppose the only thing I really want to say, I think for Dave Rennie's sake, his team's got a discipline problem at the minute. They started, listen, the way they started was brilliant. You know, unfortunately, Holloway started fantastically with a really good break. He busted a tackle early, got over the advantage line, and then within a minute he was given a yellow card for a lifting tackle, which almost, you know, it was only not far away from being a red as well. And that's a real issue for the Wallabies at the moment. Listen, I love their intent. I love the fact that they're physical and they were trying to get in the faces of the All Blacks. In fact, I think they tried the same tactic with the Springboks as well, but got a little bit of a slapping, especially in that second test. But yeah, I think that's something that Rennie has to go away and figure out.
Well, we'll be coming back to this because 29 penalties and two yellows in the Bledisloe Cup pales into comparison to the 38 and six yellows in the South Africa Pumas game. So, yes, boy oh boy, no doubt we'll be talking about this more later when we get on to the games. Next up, Joey, this is your question. How does RTS get a start even after Geordie's great showing at second 5-8? Against an above-average Wallabies side? Well, nice of you there to say above-average Wallabies side. I'm sure they're not sure everyone would agree with you on that one, but...
That's why I put that emoticon there.
but the... an injury-ravaged Wallabies side, perhaps quite true. Personally, I think RTS has come over, unfortunately, a year too late to get up to speed. I think that Sonny Williams had 2 years in France before he came back to New Zealand to get himself up to speed, and then if you think you've also, then he's also had COVID wipe out the MPC season for him last year, I just think he's had enough rugby in him to prove his worth and get into the side. But Stephen, you're a man from Auckland who gets to see him. So what do you think?
Boy, it's a bit like a traffic jam after Saturday, isn't it, fellas? Jordy Barrett really played so well. In fact, that was a pretty impressive outing in that 12 jersey. We shouldn't forget that he's played a little bit there for the Hurricanes, but he also played New Zealand under-20s in that 12 jersey. So it's not foreign to him. Unfortunately for RTS, the selectors have shown that they just don't have enough trust in him. And I think the only way that he could possibly make this All Black team is maybe a positional switch out to the wing at the moment. Because I kind of look at our wings and we probably have a couple that are probably in place, but I still think some of those wing positions are open, and that might be his only chance of getting in this Rugby World Cup team.
I'm not sure it's winger, but yeah, separate conversation is Jordy Barrett. Oh, sorry, it's not. Will Jordan only the third best fullback in the country now, as he can't seem to get that 15 jersey. But anyway, John, your thoughts on RTS?
Well, I think if he wants to get into the position, get into the All Blacks, he's got to get better. It's as plain and simple as that. He's not at the moment one of the top backs in any of the positions, and so that rests on him. You know, the All Blacks, more than any other team in the world, is about excellence. And if he wants to get in the team, he's got to be the most excellent. And so it rests on him to go away and work on his fundamental skills and find out from the coaches, whatever position he's going for, what it is that he needs to work on to be the best at that position, and then go and work on it. He comes from a professional sport. He knows about the requirements of being a professional, although to be fair, probably the environment at the Warriors is not the most professional and encouraging of excellence, right? It's really up to him. He needs to go away and put the work in to make himself the best in New Zealand at whatever position he's going for.
So, Joey, you've heard the answers. Do you think he should be? Do you think he needs to change position, or do you think he just needs to get better?
Well,
yeah, look,
Sorry, I thought you said you were posing that question to me, mate. Sorry.
And I was coming back to Joey as he asked the original question on Twitter.
Yeah, look, I totally agree with the answers that have been given by the lads here. I also believe that RTS, if he was to be a second 5'8", for instance, obviously it would have to take an injury to Jordy or, a real change again for Jordy to go back to fullback or whatever the coaches decide. But I think that RTS would need a solid game, say a good 60 minutes in that second 5'8 position against a quality side to really see whether or not he has a future in that jersey at the All Blacks. I think it's a bit soon for someone who has been touted as a second 5'8 to be pushed out onto the wing. We all know he's got a skill set that can suit a winger or a fullback, but I think it's going to come down to he just needs to bide his time, keep working hard in the background, and keep seeing if he gets selected each week. He may not in the next test, whenever that may be. Is there any November tests this year?
There's not only a full November test, but we've also got they're going to stop off in Japan for a game.
Okay.
The kind of place where he gets a run out.
Before they
play Wales.
Scotland
and England. Now, I know Stephen is worried about those Wales and Scotland games. I don't think he'd be suggesting using the experimental lineup for those games. So Japan looks like the main one that where he might be given a go. But when you're talking about injuries, you're already talking about Jack Goodhue, Antonella Brown, and Quintipire. We're talking three choices. You bring Jordy in, his fourth choice in that jersey. So that puts RTS down at the best fifth choice for the 12th jersey. which is very deep.
I was going to say, Paul, sorry to interrupt, Phyllis, that he's, if he's given the start at 12 for the Blues, and if you consider that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Probably, I would imagine Quintupiah is probably going to be up for a good part of Super Rugby. We don't know what sort of shape Jack Goodhue is going to come back. Boy, if he goes out and has a really, really good Super season, you know, he might put the put Foster and the selectors in a difficult situation where he's actually got to be picked. And you know, maybe the fact that you know, Jack Goodhue's probably got a little bit to prove coming back from injury. In fact, I think all these guys coming back from injury are going to have a bit to basically improve on or show the selectors that they're up to speed.
Yeah, Jack, you know, in Jack's next season, whereas I think Antoinette Brown should be on the November tour. So look, we haven't heard yet, I don't think, how long Quintupiah is going to be out with that horrific hit on his knee.
Look, so, I just want to add as a final thought to this is that, first of all, he made a mistake by going to the Blues. If you wanted to get into the All Blacks and you want to develop your game and you've been out of the out of rugby union for that long, the best place to go is the Crusaders. And that's what Sonny Bill Williams did coming from France, is he went to the Crusaders and he played outside of Dan Carter in that environment. And New Zealand, the whole of New Zealand rugby benefited for it. And the other thing is, I think it's not the ethos of All Black rugby to say, let me change positions to try and get in because I'm only the fifth best in this position. None of those five that you, or the four in front of him that you named, would start an All Black test ahead of Ma Nonu or Sonny Bill Williams, right? So, and so basically you're saying he's in the seventh position if you consider who's played there in the last 6 or 7 years. And if you can't improve your skills, do you deserve to be an All Black? Just shifting position, I don't know. I think we're just maybe expecting, because he was so good at league, we're expecting him, just like you said, Paul, to be at international level a little too soon. You've got to give him a bit more time, give him a bit more time at the Blues or playing at Super Rugby level to get up to speed.
I think even he was shocked that he got selected as soon as he did. But also, totally agree with you, John, that Crusaders is basically where you want to go as a league convert back to Union if you want to become an All Black like SBW did. And unfortunately for Rog, because he'd been away throughout COVID with the Warriors and based in Australia, you know, I bet his decision was largely due to the fact that he wasn't with family, and all his family in Auckland, even his immediate family. So I guess that was probably the reason why he went with the Blues in the end, to a Super Rugby detriment, I guess, if you want to talk about the Crusaders winning the bloody thing. But also, you know, it's one of those things where he just has to, if he really wants a chance, or if he wants any further opportunities in the All Blacks jersey, he's got to tick all those boxes for the coaches, for himself, for everybody. In the background, and keep working hard and keep taking whatever opportunities he gets. and try and show his skill set in whatever jersey he gets given. But yeah, I totally see where, say, Jack Goodhue, a fully fit Jack Goodhue, could come back and take ownership of their jersey once more, like he did previous years. Tupaia, unfortunately for him, like you said, Stephen, he's probably looking at a majority of the Super Rugby season out. And in World Cup year, that's probably not going to do him any favours. Then you've got Anton Leonard-Brown, who I don't know when he's due to come back, but we all know how good he is in the All Black jersey. So you've got all those players in front of him. And I'm sure he's done the math. I'm sure he's done all the, you know, the mapping out of what his journey could look like and what opportunities he needs to get in order to cement himself a spot in that squad next year for the World Cup, if that's what he's looking at. And if that's what the coaches are potentially looking at, they need to test him. They need to throw him in the deep end somewhere in one of these games this side of the new year, because that's the only real way they're going to see whether or not they're going to include him in that squad next year.
Yeah, we'll have to see what happens with that one. As I say, Japan looks like his best opportunity to nail it. But again, against a Tier 2 nation, how meaningful is that performance in the end? We'll have to wait and see on that one. Personally, yeah, I think he's probably left it too late. We're not going to see him come through. Let's move on then and talk about the games from the weekend, as we've going to overrun massively if we give either of these games the amount of time they deserve. So unfortunately, we are going to run through these very, very quickly. One of the things I like to, one of the few pieces of mainstream media I do like to look at is the Aaron Gooley's, Goyle's, sorry, not Gooley, geez. Well, I mean, that's got teased so much at school. Sorry, Aaron.
Have you got Gooley's on the brain?
Maybe I do. Aaron Goyle there. He does a by the numbers thing after each after these games. And I do find them kind of interesting and fun. So now, 48 games on the bounce that the All Blacks haven't lost at Eden Park. It does include two draws, to be fair, going back to 1994, which is absolutely nuts on that one. A talking amazing point when it comes to the what do you call it, the fallout of this game, Dave Rennie's win percentage with Australia down to 38%. That's a very low number, and there has been a number of people questioning that his whether he should stay on. Just run through a few more numbers then on this one. Sam Whitelock and Brodie Retallick have now started 63 games for the All Blacks, equaling Victor Matfield and Backes Botha's world record of starts for international locks. So congratulations to them. That's a that's two sets of very, very good locks. Let's be honest. Also, Sam Whitelock has matched Richard McCaw's record for starts. Is it starts or is it caps? Maybe it's caps, actually. With his 34th Bledisloe Cup appearance. So Richard McCaw and Sam Whitelock now lead that list, which I thought was another impressive one. So, yeah, Sam Whitelock breaking records there. I mean, showing, I guess, his longevity playing at the top level has been fantastic to be able to break those kind of records. But what how did this game go then? Very quickly, the All Blacks went out to a 17-0 lead in the first half. The Wallabies failing to execute, we probably should have put some points on the board, including Corabetti's foot on the line there. Jordan, 21 tries from 21 tests in that when he scored his try in that first half. That is a remarkable record from him, and that was a wonderful try that he scored. With the All Blacks scoring first in the second half, essentially, for my mind, that put the game to bed, and it was all over at that point at 24-0. Yeah, and the Wallabies did get a couple of consolation tries late on, so it finished 40-17, a comfortable victory for the All Blacks, and putting them in a position to go on to win the Rugby Championship. So surely, Steve, I'm going to let you have your first hot takes or your first thoughts, main sort of hot main thoughts from the game on this one. But surely, Mr. Foster's putting himself in a fantastic position, being a Bledisloe Cup and Rugby Championship winning coach. Since he's brought Ryan, Joe Schmidt into his coaching setup, boy, it's the perfect ticket to take them through to the Rugby World Cup. Everything's rosy.
Yeah, hang on, I'm just choking on my humble pie here. Probably it was a very impressive performance from the All Blacks. It was actually similar to that second test against the Pumas where, you know, something we haven't always got from the All Blacks in the last couple of years, and you've got to put that down to the opposition as well. But, you know, that was close to a complete performance that they put on, unfortunately, was made very easy by an Australian team that were just so ill-disciplined and, you know, were constantly on the back foot, especially, you know, it's not often this year that we've given a lot of praise to the All Black tight five, but also I thought the loose forward trio, I thought collectively, as a collective, that's the best this trio have actually have looked this year. They look like they were actually working in tandem, but... listen, at the end of the day, for me, it's a good win, but I don't think we'll get a real handle on where this All Black team is until they hit the Northern Hemisphere. Australians, for me, were just a little bit disappointed, but I will. I know listening to Jeremy Paul yesterday on SENZ, I actually rang him up and basically said to him, listen, if you, in a perfect world, if you could pick your best Australian team, what would it be? And let me tell you, it looked nothing like the team that they actually had on the paddock on the weekend. No doubt they've got some world-class players, and I've been really impressed with Rob Valentini. He's been very good. I think Pete Samu has been really good since he's been given that opening start ahead of Michael Hooper. But boy, they just miss a little. No doubt they've actually got some attack, but they've got to get that discipline sorted out if they're to go anywhere. But, you know, your question with regards to the All Blacks, it was definitely about a 7.5, 8 out of 10 performance from the Blacks.
So happy with the performance, but tempered with some reality as to where this performance stands, it sounds like, from Stephen. Joey, what are your thoughts from this, key takeaways or key thoughts from this game? Joe's done the same sort of thing that trick that Stephen normally does, which is he's hit the unmute.
So you're talking about the Aussie Wallabies All Blacks game, eh?
Well, yeah, Wallabies All Blacks game. What are your key thoughts or key takeaways from that game?
I think like one of the audience there was talking about defense was the main thing that I took away from it. Being a bit of a saving grace for the All Blacks to create that platform and, you know, get that, that go-forward momentum and keep it. You know, that lead was held for, a good 60 minutes before Aussie then decided to come and play and scored a couple of tries. So it was unfortunate for me as a fan of the All Blacks to see them let Aussie get to double digits. I would have hoped that they would stay on 7 or even 0. But I suppose that's the game of rugby for you. And that's, you know, the Aussie spirit. They always seem to make these comebacks out of nowhere in short amount of time. And luckily, I think for the All Blacks, it wasn't another 20 minutes on the clock where the Aussies could have, you know, probably snuck in a couple more tries in the game, would have been really interesting. I think Lomax, I agree with Nocturnal Rights. Lomax has really come on this year. I also think Ethan De Groot has come on as well. I'm really enjoying some of the banter that he's starting to put out there that's showing up on the mic. As a former front row myself, I think my preference for hooker There's Toke Aho. I really enjoy his abrasive crash and bash type of style. He seems to love the contact and the collision, which is what I enjoy watching as a fan as well. So, and it seems to be working for him. You know, it seems to be working for him, especially when it comes to, you know, those broken plays where he ends up in the back line and manages to get himself a meat pie. Those rolling mauls, I think, are still underutilized by the All Blacks. The South Africans are really good at it when they do put it on, and they seem to get a lot of meterage from it. Why not the All Blacks? You know, All Blacks, I think they need to have a bit more, I guess, faith that these rolling mauls that they put on do work when they do get a roll on.
A couple of your comments in there about the coming to play and the defence, show up in the stats. So turnovers conceded, 8 yeah. by the All Blacks, 15 by the Wallabies. Yeah, but they broke down too often. From a defensive yeah. point of view, the All Blacks made 92% of their tackles. When the team's making above 90, they're hard to break down. 82% by the Wallabies. So yeah, again, that's yeah. probably one of the big differences between these two teams. John's dropped out, but he's come back again. John, your quick your quick takeaways from this before we move on to the spring
game. Tyrell Lomax, Ethan de Groot, looked like beasts, looked like a potential long-term solutions, especially for the World Cup, which is more medium-term. Jordy Barrett at 12 looked like a real goer there, and I like something that Stephen posted after the game, that his first choice backline would be Jordy at 12, Anton Leonard-Brown at 13, move
Rico
move what's his name?
Rico
number 13. What's it?
Rico out onto the wing.
Yes, move Rico out onto the wing, keep Will Jordan, and then have Bowden Barrett at 15 and possibly Damian McKenzie back on the bench. And so you have a lot of flexibility there, a lot of players that can cover multiple positions. And if necessary, I know it's not the way New Zealand normally does it, but you can go then with a two-player on the bench, two backline players on the bench, if it's something that you're looking at countering like a big South African pack with and their bomb squad. So it opens a lot of options for you that way, because a lot of the players can cover multiple positions. I like that. And then just the tight five, as exemplified by de Groot and Lomax, really put it to the Aussies. And my final thought from the Aussies is that there are some serious concerns for me about the way Dave Rennie coaches. And it goes beyond his 38% win record. It goes to the behavior of his team. They are committing some exceedingly poor personal fouls, acts of dirty play, things that in rugby circles are just totally offside. The way that they have brought about injuries, like Quinn Tupia's injury, that was just a complete grub-like move. And what concerns me, and Steve raised it about the a couple of times already, about their discipline. Discipline is a cultural issue in an organization when it comes to playing rugby. And if you're continually losing discipline, it's a cultural issue. And that is purely the coaches are responsible for that.
Yep, no, understood where you come from that one. Yourself and Boa in our private chat, both are unhappy with particularly with some of that coaching thing. I think on the win record, I think that the All Blacks seem to have been forced into perhaps their best selection for injury, particularly around those props, and also Jordy into 12. Jordy in 12 is one of the things I've been wanting, that I've been advocating during the season. I think he's the kind of size of body. He has the kicking game, the passing game, and the running game that you want in there in that game. Yes, is he Matanonu? No, he's not. But he is. He's got a similar sort of size, or perhaps he's not quite as powerful, but he's got a more educated kicking game than Mutton, especially when he started anyway. So I think he would be I think that they've sort of been forced into good selections. From a Dave Rennie point of view, look, I wouldn't worry too much about the win record because of the vast number of injuries they've had has been crazy. Now, whether you blame that on coaching and also strength and conditioning and say, hey, that's part of the coaching thing that's causing those injuries, maybe not, I don't know. But for me, he's had far too many injuries for you to worry too much about the win record per se. So I think he's still the right guy there. Has done some very good cultural things in there. I understand the concerns around the style of injuries they've created and style through some of their clear out record, particularly by Mr. Swain, who has had a rather lucky. And I guess actually, should we be surprised that players are cheating when we see the unions at the top, the management, also looking to circumvent rules as best they can by sending Darcy Swain on the A tour? We'd know he probably would not have gone on that if it wasn't just to try and wipe out games like suspension. Is this a go at the Australian rugby? No, it's not. Look, New Zealand rugby have used a game of three halves before, and at the time I said that should not be included in a suspension. That is that's wrong. So I'm not saying that Rugby Australia, that Australia Rugby is the only one that does this. I'm saying that all unions at that level, if they see a way of adding an extra game in to a player's suspension to get him back quicker, they'll do it. Is that in the spirit of the game or the laws? No, it's not. If they're if they're looking at circumventing the laws, we probably shouldn't be surprised that the players are, or the coaches are, and the players are as well. And it's an endemic thing from top to bottom. The laws are there to be broken, not to be followed.
The thing that concerns me, Paul, is that when Darcy Swain's actions became clear on the replay and Rennie was asked about it post-match, he actually came out and defended Darcy Swain. That was the time, as the coach, maybe you don't throw your player under the bus, where you go, you just keep your mouth shut. Because anybody who's been involved in rugby and anybody who is a rugby man would know that that particular action among rugby players is considered as about as bad a thing as you can possibly do. And you can ruin a player's career by doing that. You could end his career by doing that. And every player is at some time or another in that kind of compromised position where you are held in some way or a limb is exposed in some way. And if a player comes in and wants to break your limb, all of us, no matter how strong you are, because of the way rugby is played, is in that kind of position at some time, right? So among the certain things that you know as a rugby player that are completely unacceptable are kicking in the head, rucking the face, and doing what Darcy Swain did. That is way worse than throwing a punch, right? Punches arise from niggle, from people playing a little bit dirty, a little bit of pulling of jerseys, frustrations, whatever, all considered part of the game. If you cop a punch because you were causing trouble, it happens. What Swain did is completely unacceptable in the rugby environment. And he had the audacity, that concerns me, Dave Rennie, is to come out and defend him. What he should have done is just said, listen, yeah, that's not how we like to play the game. We'd like to just move on from this, and we learned that's not okay. And just not roll him under the bus, but also be a little non-committal.
No, you'd be much more non-committal than that. So I didn't see it. I'll have to review it later. Is how you avoid the conversation. But yes, I understand. I understand where you're coming from. The only other thing I'd add into there is the king hit. Is that there's a difference between hitting someone when you're face-to-face and hitting someone from behind. They're not expecting it. But again, that one I would say is goes along with that. So in that category of stuff you don't do, hitting someone from the back.
Paul, I was going to say Rugby Australia as an organisation have also let themselves down because they haven't accepted the punishment because they've decided we'll pick them in an Australian B team, knowing that he would probably never play for that particular team anyway, just to try and knock out three games out of the six games that he was that was handed down as well. And it comes back to what I think John may have originally said about culturally as an organisation. That once again speaks to their culture as well, that they actually haven't accepted what Darcy Swain did. And listen, we'll basically do anything, whatever it takes, to get him back on the field. I think if you wanted to send a message out, I think you probably would have brought out your own suspension as well on top of the 6 weeks that he actually got. If the boot was on the other shoe, we would hear all about it. And I think the fact even that they basically rallied World Rugby on that final decision as well, and that's another conversation for another day, where World Rugby didn't even basically, I actually thought they threw Raynell under the bus. World Rugby, and they gave Australian Rugby the opportunity to actually to question that decision that was made, which was right within the rules. So maybe there is a cultural issue across Australia Rugby altogether.
Well, look, I'll disagree with you about this one, because the All Blacks have used a game of three halves to get a player back quicker as well. So yeah. I think that's a endemic across all of the unions. The adding an extra punishment on top, I think, is extremely rare unless we're talking drugs or something off the pitch. I don't think I can't remember a time on the pitch where any union has ever added an extra punishment on top. I think both of those are a little bit unfair to expect Australian Rugby to do anything different than they have done. As far as World Rugby throwing under referees under the bus, well, let's be honest, they've got a bit of history on this, haven't they? The Rugby World Cup not that long ago in England, they did the exact same thing to a referee as well, which is wrong. Look, unions are allowed to question, and there has to be an avenue to question decisions. World Rugby got the wrong answer there. The answer should have been, your player put the referee in a situation where he had to make that call. It was his fault at the end of the day on that one. Is there a culture issue around teaching or suggesting to players that's the kind of clean act you should do? Absolutely. That piece I'm fine. I can agree with. But a culture issue around trying to reduce penalties, I'm sorry, that's what all unions, I think, personally try to do. Whether it's right or whether it's morally right, no, I don't think it is. But I think, unfortunately, morals don't seem to get in the way of this. It's letter of the law rather than sending the right messages, even though we expect players to be paradigms of virtue and role models. For some reason, the unions don't think they should be role models in that kind of same kind of way. It's double standards that we've seen, across a number of sports, not just this one.
Yeah. Listen, this is the downside about clearing up rugby. The downside about clearing up rugby is that Darcy Swain would have been sorted in the old days. Like, there's no question. The next time he plays the All Blacks, Darcy Swain would have been carried from the field, right? Because he would have been knocked out cold, right? And the players would have dealt with it. Now, you can't do that these days. But the upshot of it is if Quintupaya's career is affected, I would 100% say to him he should sue Swain. 100% for loss of earnings, right? And that is what's going to come if rugby does not take action on these kind of things, you know?
Take action, that's the only way we can get change, unfortunately. The fact that it happened in Australia rather than New Zealand means he's actually probably got a leg to stand on. Unfortunately, New Zealand law with things like the ACC probably would mean that he wouldn't be able to. But anyway, that's another issue. And let's move on to the Springboks up against the Pumas. Look, I've not watched all this game. I watched through until early in the second half. In that first half, though, it finished 17-7 at halftime. But the Springboks chasing a bonus point and also needing to get a big points difference for the rugby championship. You've got to say that the only time they got their tries were when Argentina had picked up yellow cards. That had to be a bit concerning for the Springboks, not in so much the win, but in as could they get enough of the score to overhaul the All Blacks points difference in the end. They didn't do that. Argentina got themselves back into the game early in the second half, getting it 17-12. But four yellow cards in the second half. Oh, my God. As I say, 38 penalties in this game. Now, look, we can complain about referees, but at the end of the day, if the players, it's the players who do things that the referees blow on. That one clearly got a bit silly in this one, to a level that I think a lot of people found hard to watch, unfortunately, on this one. But what do we have? 42 lineouts, and a further 11 scrums, as well as the, as I say, the 38 penalties. Boy, oh boy, a lot of stoppages in this game and resets. If you couldn't score a first phase, then you probably were going to be in trouble in this one, looking at how often the game stopped. I say, I didn't watch the whole thing. John, I'm sure you did. Your key takeaways from this one? Am I being a bit unfair with some of those comments?
No, not at all. South Africa were in a position that is almost unique to this competition, maybe the Six Nations the same, where they needed to win the competition by scoring lots of tries, and they are not trained, they are not coached to be a team that scores lots and lots of tries. So they reaped what they have sown for the last 4 years or 5 years, 6 years, whatever it may be. They play a style of rugby that is focused around winning each test and not about scoring a bunch of points. So now they try to click into that mode, which is what was required to win the tournament, and they just didn't have the structures and they didn't have the skill set, some of them, as exemplified by Damien Delende, who tried to distribute the ball behind the one-off runner coming on his inside, like some of the number 12s would do for New Zealand and for Australia. And a number of times his pass just wound up on the grass because he just doesn't have the distribution skills for that. So basically what I would say to any team that's playing against South Africa in the future and in the World Cup is, if Delender gets the ball, he is either going to he's probably 70% of the time, 75% of the time going to run it straight up, or he's going to pass to 13, right? He's going to pass to the runner right next to him. He's not going to produce some wonderful magical distribution because he can't. Right. The other thing that struck me as well is that Francois Steyn was a little too overeager. He was almost trying too hard. He missed a few penalty kicks to touch because he was trying to bite a little bit too much and try and kick the leather off the ball. And that's probably an indicator, if you wanted one, that the last time he started a match at 10 for South Africa was 14 years ago. I mean, 2008, he started at 10. So I think that he's very much an option at 10, but you've got to give him game time, and you've got to just tell him at times Francois Steyn, with all of his talent, can be like an over-anxious schoolboy player, and just say to him, you know, just calm down, trust yourself, don't grasp too much for it. And my other thought was Juan Martín González.
González is making a good case of being the best blindside flanker in the world at the moment.
Yes, he is a superstar in the making. He really and truly is a superstar in the making. And for me, one of the potential players of the tournament, and depending on how he goes in the end of your tour for Argentina, he might make the shortlist for World Player of the Year, which is great for Argentina. It's great for them to have somebody to look up to. And the other thing, the final thought is, heaven help any team that plays against South Africa in their back line. If South Africa if Arm comes back and South Africa starts Francois Steyn, Damien Delende, and Arm at 13, and the South African first five is 113 kilograms, then I wouldn't like to be trying to attack. I wouldn't like to be trying to take the ball up or try and stop the heavy runners, because a couple of times the Argentinians ran at Francois Steyn, and he picked the players up like they were rag dolls and held them in the air.
A couple of things in that. We'll remember that we're missing both Pollard and Willemse and Am in that back line. So we are missing. This is not a first choice Springboks back line by any stretch of the imagination. And
Jantjies wasn't available for selection because of the scandal going on there as well. So it was the fourth choice.
Yep, absolutely. We look at some of the names in this, and you've got to say that perhaps South Africa. Also relying on you've got players like Jesse Creel, Francois Steyn. You've also got who's the number eight, the old number eight that wasn't starting in the as well.
Vermeulen.
There's definitely a number of really aging players in here that perhaps are I would say past their best, to be honest. There is a bit of a dad's army look to a kind of like a third or of this team. I know they said the same about the 2003 England rugby team and on to win the Rugby World Cup, but a dad's army bit to that, which I think perhaps I thought the last Rugby World Cup would be their final hurrah. But anyway, John, I'm going to have to
look,
move
I
on.
Think, I think Jesper Willemse is something I should have mentioned. He was man of the match, who his emergence from major prominence in English Premiership rugby, to be fair, to this season really stepping up, and he is now the first choice ahead of Dwayne Vermeulen at eight, is very telling. And he is starting to have a major impact as a ball carrier for the Boks.
Okay, moving on then. Thank you, John. Mr. Harris, your thoughts on this one? Any points to add after... about how stop-start it was, and also how wonderful
I think John summed it up pretty well. You know, I don't think they were ever going to entertain a situation of going out and playing an open style again, because that would have just suited Argentina to no end. It was really about getting the victory, and you know, you could kind of see in those first four tries that they basically went back to the strength that they knew. First try was a pushover, great control, and I was going to say some good discipline by the Argentinian loose forward. It would have easier to have fallen in there, but that would have been another yellow card to go with the five other yellow cards that we actually saw in this game. And when they play to their strengths, they are very, very brutal. Brutal side. What you see is what you get. They come with the instructions already on the label how they're going to play. It's up to another team just to counter how they play. But obviously the moment of the match was Gonzalez with that step. I think I felt a bit sorry for Willie LaRue, because I'm pretty sure in his own mind he thought he was going to chop in. No way in the world would a loose forward try and take him on the outside, and poor old Willie was unfortunately so wrong-footed. But what impressed me was the actual pace that he actually showed to get to the corner, even with the cover defense coming across. Man, that was pretty amazing. But it's like, I think South Africa secretly they probably missed a trick in winning this championship, and they'll probably look back to that moment and their last, probably when you think about it, and this is how small the margins are, they'll probably think back to that last several minutes in Joburg at Ellis Park against the All Blacks. That was probably the winning and losing of this championship. They win that one, and it's pretty much theirs quite comfortably. So I think it'll be a little bit of a rock in the back of their shirts there. But on saying that, as John rightly said, they introduced a new number eight and one of the wingers, which I've just forgotten the winger's name, who looked really good. So, you know, whilst there is a few elder guys in there, I think it's good that they've actually introduced some new guys into the Springbok team, onwards and upwards. And I'll certainly be watching them on their trip up to the Northern Hemisphere, as well I will be the All Blacks ball.
Look, I mean, so you're talking about Moody. Is that young winger who's come in and played fantastically. You've a 2 points game decided this championship. So this is one of the best championships we have seen in a very, very long time. The fact that it came down to that game. Coming after four games, all the teams on two wins, two losses. It finished up New Zealand on 19 points, South Africa just behind on 18, Australia on 10, and then Argentina on 9. So a lot of those decisions made on just single points. So fantastic piece from that, from all those ones. And yeah, as John reminds me in the private chat there, we're also missing a certain Chesson Colby, who I think is a decent player occasionally on his day. Other times, you know, he can be a bit hit and miss. So yeah, so about half of that back line is not first choice. So a number of which again, the fact that we can forget that Chesson Colby is available shows the depth in South African rugby as well. So along with New Zealand, look, two of the great producers of rugby talent in the world, and we see them jetting off around the world to various places like the Premiership, where clubs are going bust. But hey, there we go. Thank you. Any sort of final points from the world of rugby that any of you would like to bring up, folks? Just while you're having a quick think of that, I'll go around the houses. I'll just remind everybody tomorrow, if you are in Tauranga, head along to Bay of Plenty versus Northland at Tauranga Domain. Kickoff 4:05. Myself and Stephen Harris will be there. So look out for the bucket hat and come and say hello if you are at the game, please. Stephen, any thoughts from the last week or so in rugby that you want to finish on?
Just finally, listen. If we have championships like this, rugby championships like this every year, I'm hopeful that South Africa actually stays, as opposed to going north, John. So that's pretty much the first thing. And other than that, Paul, I just want to know where we're going for dinner tomorrow night down in Tauranga after the Northern Bay of Plenty game.
We'll figure something out. My plan at the moment is to ask the Bay of Plenty staffers to give us a restaurant recommendation around there, because I've not eaten in that area. But if you know of any good restaurants in the area around Tauranga Domain, hit me up at Driving Mall on Twitter and do let us know so that myself, Stephen, and my parents can go and have a nice old meal. Joey, any final thoughts on rugby from the last week or so?
No, but I do have a recommendation.
Oh, go ahead.
If you run out of ideas, the Trinity Wharf does really good dinner.
There we go. So Trinity Wharf is going to be Googled, and we'll check out the recommendations on there. Thank you very much for that, Joey. John, any final thoughts on rugby from the last couple of weeks?
Oh, I just wish that there was a Springbok All Black match to be played in New Zealand. I realise that there's scheduling issues, but it would be so great if there was a third match. And especially if there was one in New Zealand where we could see those top two teams play each other, both home and away. I don't know what the schedule is for next year. I know it's a World Cup year, so we might not get as many games, but maybe we might be fortunate enough to see South Africa play twice in New Zealand. And that would be really great, I think, for the New Zealand public. Because for me at the moment, with the possible exception of Ireland, to be fair, and France. These are the two primary.
Two teams in the world.
Yes.
And you've got South Africa and New Zealand behind them at the moment. Yeah. And unless we see different on the November tours. But yeah. You're right. Quite right. Next year, obviously, with the. There'll be less. What's the word I'm looking for? Less games because of the. Because we're in the World Cup, I'm not sure. I hate people who say they're not sure when they haven't got a fucking clue. So yes, I haven't got a clue as to what we're going to do next year. Let's be absolutely honest. We'll have to wait until we see an announcement. Thank you very much, John. Thank you very much, Stephen. And thank you very much, Joey, on your debut here at this one. Simon says, from his understanding, there'll be two games against Africa in New Zealand next year. That I very much doubt, but I could be wrong. If I am, then so be it. It's been known to happen once or twice before, but not very often. Thank you, everybody. Don't forget, at Driving Mall on Twitter, New Zealand Sport Radio, Facebook page, and stay safe, folks. Have a great week.
Ciao, everyone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.